Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Bubblequake when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, private rights. But we also use terms like stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and licenses and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? And bonds are the exact opposite to private property? And public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights? Permits are the exact opposite to private business? And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by agencies of government like OSHA and the EPA and the State Tax Commission and Zoning and Planning or the IRS, these swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. And if you'd like to learn more about this thing called private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what it is you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call right now the number 417-273-4967 to order yours. That's, again, area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the three sectors or the three segments of our economy. That was capital goods. Capital goods, that means industries and businesses like autos or construction, building houses and making automobiles. Then there's the discretionary section of our economy. Discretionary, that means Jordache or Gucci. The kinds of things, you know, that you can live without, but they're kind of neat to have, and so we like to go down to the mall and buy these real neat toys. And then we finally get down to the biggest part of our economy, about 40% of it, which is the necessities. You know, things like gasoline to put in that car so you can go to work. So in these three sectors, we found out that capital goods and discretionary income, or discretionary businesses, discretionary section of our economy, is going to take a big hit. It did in the last Great Depression, and we don't have any reason to believe that it won't in the next. Now, the place to position yourself is in necessities, and I pointed out to you that necessities are those areas of the economy where people will repair their used car before they will buy a new one. When you're on unemployment insurance, you're not going to be thinking more or in terms of, gee, can I have a new SUV this year? You'll be thinking more in terms, what is it going to cost me to repair the car I've got, or what is it going to cost me to buy a used car? So used, remember, is a big segment of the necessities economy when we're in slack times, when the bubbles burst. But what kind of a scenario is going to lead us into that bubble quake, as Wiedemeyer so charmingly puts it? The guy's name now, remember, is David Wiedemeyer, W-I-E-D-E-M-E-R. He's a conventional economist, and he's now written a book called America's Bubble Economy, Profit When It Pops. And I've been pointing out that, you know, you can be a little guy driving a truck, or you're driving a taxi cab, or delivering pizza, or doing whatever it is that you're doing. We all have a little bit in the way of assets, and what would we do if we were living in 1927, 28, and 29, if you had some advance information that about October of 1929, the stock market's going to break, it's going to burst, and that bubble's going to pop, and it's going to lead into a seven-year period of time when we're going to have a Great Depression. It's almost like riding the Titanic. You know, if somebody gave you some advance information, say a day or two before the ship actually hits the iceberg and says, the ship isn't going to make it to New York. It's going to hit an iceberg and it's going to sink, and 1,500 people are going to die and only 800 are going to be saved. What would you do to position yourself, to give yourself the best possible opportunity to get off the Titanic, or in this case, to get off of the great ship America? Well, he starts out in chapter 3 called Bubble Quake, a likely scenario of how our bubbles will collide and fall. And he said that despite the persistent chorus of economic cheerleading, insisting that all is well and the economy is growing, the price for the biggest, stupidest economic mistake the United States has ever made, borrowing a tower of money from foreign investors more than three times taller than the moon, will inevitably crash down on us like a bursting city built
precariously on a fault line, and most Americans have no idea that a financial earthquake is about to rattle their world in the next few years. Smart and reasonable people who see it coming can prepare ahead of time to cover their assets and potentially make huge profits on the coming bubble quake. To join the fortunate few, it is important to understand what will happen and to track the timing of events so that you can come to your own reasonable conclusion, make your own well-thought-out moves. If you'd like more details and updates about timing the bubble, visit our webpage. What follows is our best guess about how and when the coming bubble quake will occur before we venture into the realm of rational speculation. Let's review what we already know. We know that our dollar is overvalued because the Chinese and the Japanese have now bought 1.75 trillion of our dollars to prop up its price. Therefore, we have an artificially inflated dollar bubble. And we know that our stocks are overpriced because the Dow has increased tenfold in 20 years without an equal rise in real earnings. Therefore, we have an overvalued stock market. We know that our homes are overvalued because personal incomes and population growth have not increased at anywhere near the same pace as the pace of building new homes and condominiums. So therefore, we have an overpriced real estate bubble. And we know that we have too much consumer debt, well, compared to our incomes, and we're very vulnerable if we enter a period of high interest rates. Therefore, we have an overextended consumer debt bubble. And we know that we import far more than we export, with the difference now nearing $1 trillion a year. Therefore, we have a huge international trade deficit bubble. And we know that we have astronomical government debt, now at more than $8 trillion at the federal level, not to mention how much our states and cities and counties owe, which is heavily funded by foreign capital and that may not wish to stay forever. Therefore, we have a vulnerable government deficit bubble. Now, certainly, anyone who ran their personal finances this way would be living on the brink of disaster. No breadwinner can support his family indefinitely by borrowing far more money than he earns. No homeowner in his or her right mind would take out a 30-year mortgage from a banker who would show up at her door at any time of the day or night and demand the entire note be paid in full on a moment's notice. And yet, that's exactly the position that we have put ourselves in here in America with our astronomical debt to these foreign investors who now hold huge amounts of our stocks, government debt, and our private debt, and who may not wish to do so for very much longer. And now, any day now, they're going to come calling. So what's going to cause our bubbles to fall? They haven't yet, so what makes us think that they're going to anytime soon? Well, it would be far more dramatic if we could say that the U.S. bubble economy will fall because of some single extraordinary event such as a terrorist attack or a worldwide pandemic of bird flu. While such terrible events are always possible, a big dramatic trigger is far less likely than a simple or a long, slow squeeze. Rather than being shot with a single bullet, our bubbles will most likely deflate due to a long and insidious change in long-term investor psychology, although a single bad event could hasten that change at any time. Even if a dramatic negative event does occur, it cannot in and of itself do any lasting damage to the economy unless long-term investor psychology has significantly changed. A single event could no more trigger an explosion than a detonator can without any dynamite next to it. The explosive has to build up before it can be detonated. And looking at past bubbles over history, it's easy to see this pattern. No great event caused the October 29, 1929 stock market collapse that led to the Great Depression. There was no big tragedy precipitating the bursting of the interest bubble in March of 2000. There was no monumental moment of insight that led to the universal loss of interest in buying a single 17th century Dutch tulip bulb for twice the value of your own home. In each of these cases, the only thing different about the day that the bubble popped compared to the day before it popped was simply a shift in investor psychology. And this makes perfect sense when you think about it. After all, bubbles go up because of investor psychology. So naturally, a change in investor psychology is all it takes to bring them down. Group psychology, or mass psychology, is so profoundly linked to inflating, maintaining, and destroying a bubble that even if a big destabilizing event does happen, such as a war or an epidemic, that alone cannot make a bubble fall, unless that dramatic event also happens to coincide with a shift in long-term investor psychology, as we saw after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Big negative events can have a temporary negative impact on the economy. But unless there's long-term psychology that has significantly changed, the economic dip eventually reverses itself and the bubble stays afloat, at least for a while longer. So what is going to change the long-term investor psychology in the future? a flat stock market vulnerable to shocks. And as with every issue we discuss in this book, the experts can and do spend years analyzing all of this data and debating every detail. You can see it in Lou Dobbs or on the money shows on television. You can drive yourself crazy trying to track every argument, or you can bypass the threes and trees and step back and see the forest. Now, the most likely cause of a change in long-term investor psychology is not likely to be the usual suspects, such as terrorism, rising oil prices, or the outsourcing of U.S. jobs. Far more likely, investor psychology will turn increasingly negative simply because of the flatness of the U.S. stock market. And although rarely reported in the media, something very important has been happening to the value of stocks, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, since mid-2000. Very little. Overall, these stock prices have not only failed to rise, but adjusted for inflation, they have actually gone down and lost value. Given that these blue-chip stocks remain stable during the internet bubble crash, you would expect to see some significant growth since 2000, but it hasn't happened. Instead, we have had the worst-performing stock market in the world. The Dow Jones averages down 5% from its peak in 2000 to mid-2006, compared to the Japanese stock market, which shot up almost 50% in the same period. When adjusted for inflation, the Dow Industrial is actually down even more significantly over the same period of time. Naturally, such tepid performance over such a long period of time tends to cool investor enthusiasm, especially for our oh-so-critical foreign investors who also face a currency exchange rate risk. The longer that our stock market remains in a no-grow or a slow-growth mode, the more damaging an effect it's going to have on long-term investor psychology, especially foreign investor psychology. So wait a minute. Can't a no-growth or slow-growth stock market go on for years? Well, it is true. The answer is yes. A no-growth or a slow-growth stock market absolutely can go on for years and years. And if we didn't already have a bubble? Well, Japan has managed to maintain its flat stock market for many years, but not when they had a bubble. Back when Japan's Nikkei index was up over 40,000, when it was maintaining a flat stock market at 40,000, it proved to be impossible to maintain it at that level. So we, too, could maintain slow growth or no growth for many years, if we didn't have a stock market bubble, that is. Now remember, current stock prices are overvalued relative to actual earnings. The Dow has increased more than 10 times in the past two decades, from 1982 to 2000, and it did it without an equal rise in real earnings during that same period. The dollar lost about 50% of its value in that 20-year period. To put this increase into perspective, in the five decades prior to 1980, a time of enormous economic growth in our country, the stock market grew a reasonable 300%. But then, in the two decades after 1980, the market shot up a whopping 1,000%. That kind of irrational growth means that we have a bubble, and you cannot maintain a bubble like that indefinitely with no growth or with slow growth. Keeping a big fat bubble up in the air defying economic gravity over a long period of time takes more excitement than that. Irrational exuberance requires a certain minimum amount of exuberance, like a hot air balloon. The current stock market needs a fairly steady supply of heat to keep it up. If it stays too cool for too long, our stock market bubble will become increasingly vulnerable to any downward tug. So what could push the lackluster stock market down? Well, there are two forces: falling real estate values and a declining value of the dollar. And both of those events are now in play. So if everything else was fine, we could probably make our overvalued stock market bubble hover in the air, going neither up nor down for many more years. But at this particular moment in time, however, we happen to have two other simultaneous financial factors putting downward pressure on the stock market. In the near term, the slow collapse of the real estate bubble in some markets — it won't be so slow in some markets, and it'll be faster in others — but it's going to weigh heavily on the stock market. The loss of housing, construction jobs, and plus the factory and service jobs that support housing construction will further slow the economy, putting more downward pressure on the stock market. The mildly declining dollar bubble is also putting downward pressure on the stock market. Declines in the U.S. dollar relative to the euro don't inspire tremendous confidence in the overall U.S. economy or the U.S. stock market. Efforts by Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke to maintain the value of the dollar by raising interest rates will help attract foreign investments and foreign investors, but make money more expensive for home mortgages at the same time. Now, U.S. businesses and individuals have to borrow money, and the stock market doesn't like higher interest rates. So as the dollar continues to slip and interest rates rise, the value of U.S. stocks will slip as well. If interest rates don't rise, which we can't raise interest rates because it's going to harm housing, then foreign investors will be less attracted to American investments. So eventually, as the stock market bubble declines toward 8,000, overall investor confidence in the U.S. economy will also decline. Waning foreign investor confidence in U.S. stocks, bonds, real estate, and the dollar, coupled with a pull toward greater profits elsewhere in the world, will all work together to eventually spook the most conservative pension funds and life insurance investors and foreign investors to bring a sell-off of their U.S. stocks and other U.S. assets in a move to safety and a desire for better returns with other investments. This will cause the dollar bubble to seriously fall, forcing the rest of our bubbles to burst. Now remember, we've got several of these bubbles. Remember, the debt bubble, the stock market bubble. We have the housing bubble. We have the international trade deficit bubble. We have the government deficit bubble. If you put all of these bubbles together, there's never been a time in history when any nation has ever faced a bubble economy such as ours. It's true that we've had one or two bubbles at a time, but count them up. We now have six bubbles, all working at the same time, like a juggler trying to keep six balls in the air all at the same time. When the dollar begins to significantly fall, foreign investors obviously will not find buying U.S. stocks, mortgages, government bonds, and other U.S. assets nearly as appealing as they were when the dollar was on its way up. Decreasing demand for U.S. bonds will automatically drive interest rates even higher. Now remember, the government can't function without a constant flow of loans. So if investor demand for U.S. bonds drops, we certainly are not going to stop selling them. Instead, we will have to make them more attractive by raising our interest rates. Rising interest rates will dramatically drive stock values down even further. Higher interest rates coupled with falling stocks will further depress the economy and the stock market. Rising interest rates will also further deflate the real estate bubble as cheap mortgages disappear, again putting downward pressure on the economy and the stock market. And as these bubbles fall, investor psychology will further deteriorate. You might want to keep in mind here that this process occurs over long periods of time. Keep in mind that the stock market bubble from the lows of 1982 to the high of 2000, we're talking 18 years. These events occur over long, protracted periods of time. When the government, that is the Federal Reserve in this case, entered into the stock market with the plunge protection team back in 2000, they started injecting funds, that is, created dollars, liquidity, into the stock market, into the economy, which then created our current housing bubble. So we traded one bubble, the stock bubble, for a bigger bubble, the housing bubble, and it's been going on now for 6 years. Now, the reports that we see when we're watching the television, when we're watching the news, they're reporting on the markets and they're reporting on the economy every day, every day. When you're watching Katie Couric, she reports on the Dow Jones was up 100 points today, or the Dow was down 30 points today, or the Dow for the week was up or down 3%. And we have this constant updating day by day of the events that are transpiring. The other day, the president was on right after his speech concerning the Iraq surge, and he said, our economy is strong, and it's growing. Yes, it's true. The economy is growing. I think it's a subjective conclusion to say that it's strong. The economy is growing at about 1.6% per annum as of the fourth quarter of 2006. Inflation is growing at the rate of 10% plus per annum. Now, when I take 1.6% and subtract that from 10%, that tells me that the economy is contracting by 8% or more. The president doesn't tell us about that. They give us some of the facts, but not all of the facts. Now, truth plus truth equals truth, and error plus error equals error. But boys and girls, truth plus error also equals error. Now, most Americans think in terms of linear effect in dollar value. If you receive a 3.8% rise or raise in your pay, that means that if you're making $1,000 a week or $1,000 a month and you get a 3.8% raise, you've got another $38 to spend. But if inflation is going up at the rate of 10% a year, and if you get a 3.8% raise, which the president made a big thing over the other day, take 3.8% from 10%, and doesn't that give you about a 6% plus decline in your standard of living? How long will foreign investors take the declining value of the dollar and the flat stock market and bond markets and the downward trend in the real estate market to at some point in time say, you know, I think I'll put my money in Japan or some other place? And we Americans now need close to $3 billion a day to maintain our standard of living, to maintain our economy. What if you had an income of $3,000 a month, and you had to maintain that $3,000 a month income by borrowing $300 a month on your credit cards, and you've got a $10,000 limit on your credit cards? You know, we could predict that with $10,000 divided by $300, that in 33 months, we would be out of money. Well, you know, we Americans can do that by taking a look at the numbers and say, you know, the American economy is already out of money, has been out of money for a long time, and the question arises, how long will the credit card company extend credit? When you have a credit limit on your credit card, we can compute it out with specificity. When we go to the credit card company and say, gee, we've maxed out our card at 10,000, will you up our limit to 25? That's speculation. I don't know if they will or not. And that's what we're all sitting back waiting for now. Will foreign investors up our credit rating, and will they give us more credit to spend? And even if they do, does that mean that we can max out that credit line, or does that mean that at some point in time we've got to get our house in order and start consuming less than we're spending? And if that's the case, when do you and I plan to stop the binge and take a lower standard of living? Is there a date on that one? Hang on, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information now about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our webpage, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Let me give you a reminder that we're offering a new class on health and healing, which covers the alternative health methods being used for treatment and healing of such things as cancer and Parkinson's disease and these degenerative diseases that now approach about 50%, affects about 50% of Americans, and how to prevent these degenerative diseases and how to use the do the application of essential oils, super nutritional foods, and the class also includes hands-on teaching, paperwork, allergic reaction testing and training, so you can find pressure points and use those to contribute to your ongoing better or good health. Class is coming in February. That'll be February the 5th through the 9th here in Isabella, Missouri. And if you're interested, you can call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. And also, I have one more thing here. I need a supplier for some Indian black salve. And if you know what Indian black salve is, I won't describe it, but if you know what it is and you have a source, would you share it with me? And then finally, in Austin, Texas, February 26th through March the 2nd, we'll be putting on a tax school. I'll be in Austin, Texas, or the environs thereof, February 26th through March 2nd, 5-day school on tax and status, live and direct in Austin, Texas. Let me shift to the privateer, number 569. It's the mid-January issue. Talking about this economy here in the United States, and now for something even bigger, Buckler puts the headline. He said, what's bigger? Well, what's bigger is the global credit explosion of 2006. In terms of all of human economic history, there has never been a year like 2006 in regard to the total amount of credit issued on a worldwide basis. God, what a headline. Let me read that to you again. Let's see if we can understand the import of this. Worldwide, 2006 is the biggest year in the history of the world for putting new money into circulation. And it's not just in the United States, it's worldwide. Total global debt jumped 14% from 2005 to a record $7 trillion. That's a world record. Economically, on a worldwide basis, the global economy has not expanded by 14%. But the money supply has expanded 14%. The world's global winner in credit issuance, and therefore debts piled up, is the United States of America. Total U.S. debt issuance over the calendar year 2006 increased by 10% to more than $4 trillion. All by itself, the United States has been responsible for about 60% of the entire global credit that has been issued in the calendar year 2006. It is the financial transmission mechanism of the U.S. trade deficits, which in turn cause credit expansions everywhere in the world. Now, the United States is a void of economic delusion. Quite a statement. Economic delusion. The hard facts are directly in the preceding paragraph. Not only did the United States expand its own credit issuance by a massive 10% in 1 year, the year 2006, but in numerical terms, it expanded its credit issuance by an enormous $4 trillion in 1 year. Now, any nation which expands its credit issuance at a faster rate than its real producing economy is growing is borrowing a higher standard of living today at the cost of having a higher debt owed tomorrow. So the real U.S. economy certainly did not expand by 10% in the calendar year 2006. The grotesque and dangerous U.S. credit numbers are ominous. The size of the U.S. economy was supposedly about $12 trillion, a sum total financial transactions conducted in the United States in 2006 on a full numerical gross domestic product basis. That's $12 trillion. That's what they're reporting to us. But the U.S. economy borrowed $4 trillion in 2006. Did you hear that, boys and girls? The president reports to us, oh my God, we're having this unprecedented growth in the economy. The economy is growing, he tells us. It's $12 trillion a year, but one-third of it, $4 trillion, is money that's being created and put out there for us to borrow on our credit cards and on our mortgages. Now, what in the hell does that tell us? What's that all about? Well, if the United States had stood with a stable credit system with total loans neither increasing nor decreasing over 2006, that borrowed $4 trillion would not have been there to have been spent. But if that $4 trillion of borrowed money had not been there, the U.S. economy would have contracted to $8 trillion on a full GDP basis. And that would have been a GDP contraction of about 33%. Now, that's a vastly greater contraction than what happened back in the days of the Great Depression in the 1930s. Economically, this is the danger. Were the U.S. credit machine to ever slow down, even slightly, in its rate of loan issuance and new credit being extended to borrowers, the U.S. economy would in short order register this as a contraction, and that and then is a real and potential cataclysmic U.S. economic recession. Boys and girls, not only is inflation running at 10% a year, it has to grow at 10% a year and then higher next year and then higher the year after. Now, inflation's been running at a little less than 10%. That is, the money issuance and creation of new money has been running a little less than 10% from 2000 until 2005. It increased to 10.9% in 2006, and it's now up to 11.9% going into 2007. And boys and girls, in 2008, they'll have to raise it again. You can't slow down the money machine. But boys and girls, borrowing more money might give you a temporary higher standard of living. But that's not an increase in pay. And ultimately, at some point in time, you're going to max out your credit card. So we're on a treadmill. We can't slow down. because if we slow it down, this thing's going to collapse. Furthermore, when the United States economy goes into recession, the rest of the world goes into recession right behind us, because we're the engine. We Americans are the engine of the economies of the rest of the world. That's why those economies like China and Japan, Formosa and South Korea and the Philippines and so on are exporting all of their goods to the United States. And we're buying all of those goods by printing up 3x5 cards and passing them out and saying, I owe you. You know, Americans used to be a productive engine, a productive economy. In 1960, 60%, a little over 60% of our economy was predicated upon production. Today, it's down to 13% and declining. We've become a service economy. We Americans used to be the breadbasket of the world. We used to export food around the world. We were the world's number one creditor nation. We lent money around the world. Today, we're the world's number one debtor nation. And today, we're actually importing as much food as we export in dollar terms. And 50% now of the food that's being imported into the United States, 50% of what we actually eat on our tables is being imported into the United States. And a more troubling number is that 27% of that food that we're importing into the United States is under the control of the Red Chinese. Now, boys and girls, do you honest to God believe that that's a good policy? I guess we're being told that the Chinese are our friends, those communists over there in Red China. They're just real nice guys, people that we want to do business with. If the Chinese were to sell off any significant portion of their U.S. assets, it would throw our economy into instant depression. And honest to God, do you think that that kind of power in the hands of your enemies? Let's put it this way. Do you think that kind of power in the hands of your friends is a good place for you to be, much less in the hands of your enemies? And our president tells us, stick with me, stay the course, and the economy is growing. That's why William Buckler points out that we're suffering from economic delusion here in the United States. Economic delusion. This report, by the way, comes from The Privateer. The Privateer is published in Queensland, Australia. If you'd like to get a copy of it, I'm sure that you can get it. It's number 569. It's a dynamite issue. The mid-January issue, 2007. And they've got a web page. It's called theprivateer.com. And there's a hyphen in the title between the and privateer. So it's The Privateer. It's the-privateer.com. And their webpage, if you want to, or their email rather, is CAPT. CAPT at the-privateer.com. I highly recommend the Privateer, and that's because every issue is like an economics 101 primer. This guy has a real knack at teaching. His name is William Buckler. And it's every issue, you know, I've been around for a while. I've been reading economic newsletters, you know, for years. And there's hardly an issue that goes by that I don't learn something from this guy. And every issue, he's on top of the news as it relates to economies worldwide, not just the United States, but Europe, Australia, China, Japan, and puts the story together in an economics 101. So if you're a truck driver, a cab driver, or you're working at the Pizza Hut, or whatever you're doing, you're a plumber, a carpenter, electrician, I don't care. If you want to know and understand something about the economy and economics and where we're going from here, and I can't recommend a better publication than The Privateer. Now he's got more good news. And he goes on to say that the $4 trillion of borrowed money, if it hadn't been there, our economy wouldn't be running at $12 trillion. It would be running at $8 trillion. And economically and financially, the U.S. economy is in a situation where the powers that be dare not slow the U.S. credit machine even slightly. We can't even slow down. Boys and girls, that spells hyperinflation. That's banana republic time. That's Weimar republic time that we saw in Germany in the 1920s. So it follows economically and inherently, as well as by definition, that if borrowers are overextended, so are all of those who lent the sums to those same borrowers. That puts on the table the U.S. financial system itself. Simply put, in economic terms, it would be the same as a man with an annual salary of $80,000 who had borrowed an additional $40,000 to bring his standard of living up to $120,000 a year. Then, suddenly finding that he now had to service his entire debt load out there out of the $80,000 annual salary. Depending upon the height of his debts, that would take his standard of living down way below the annual salary of $80,000. And sooner or later, he would have to say to hell with it and walk away from his debts. Now, we Americans have done that twice in our history. We walked away from our debts in 1783 and 1933. And we're going to do it again. There's going to be a massive transfer of wealth. And what we're talking about here is when we transfer this wealth, are you going to be a transferee or are you going to be a recipient of? I guess a transferor or a recipient of. I want to be on the receiving end, not the paying end. So at that point, those who have lent to him take a hit. And it's true that financial institutions deal with the write-offs of bad loans on an ongoing basis. It is simply seen as a normal cost of doing business. But what if an entire economy begins to walk away? If that happens, the entire financial system is in the gravest of danger and institutional collapses are approaching. This is what is known as a systemic risk. Now, we saw that occur down in Argentina in 2001. The nation went bankrupt. That doesn't mean that you die the next morning because the nation goes bankrupt. It means that over a period of time, there's going to be a massive transfer of wealth, and it'll probably be your house being transferred to the mortgage holder, which then leaves you in the position of, well, where am I going to live next? Your job may be outsourced, or you may be laid off. Your company may go bankrupt. So where are you going to work next? Today, internal U.S. systemic risks are enormous because of the credit debauch over the past decade. But so are the global system risks, in turn, caused by the U.S. trade and current account debauches over the past decades. These debauches have seen the U.S. economy fall into global deficit and external debt, which today exceeded all past historic economic precedent. The growing danger to the world is that the United States might walk away from its enormous external debts, leaving lenders to the United States to take the hit. Now picture this. The Chinese are sitting on about $1 trillion. $1 trillion, that's 1,000 billion, and 1 billion is 1,000 million. And they're sitting on all of this U.S. paper, all of these IOUs. And if the United States devalues the dollar, if the value of the dollar goes from 80 to 40, it wipes out one half of those reserves. How would you like to have $100,000 in the bank and all of a sudden we have a revision and your bank account now holds $50,000 in purchasing power? That's quite a hit. I don't think you'd be very happy about that. I wouldn't be very happy about that. And yet that's precisely what happened in 1933 when the value of gold was revised from $20.67 to $35 an ounce. That's a 60% change in the valuation. That's a 60% devaluation of the value of your savings account. Now that's not unprecedented. That goes on. It has gone on. It's historical. It's been going on for thousands of years. And the people in Russia about 5 or 6 years ago went through the same thing. They simply closed the banks on Friday, and you woke up on Monday and you had a devaluation. On Friday, you had $100,000 in the bank, and on Monday morning, you had $30,000 in the bank, and a new color of money. They did it in Brazil. They put a cap on the money that you had in the bank, and the government came in and took all the money that you had and left you with $1,600. So if you had $100,000 in the bank, $50,000 in the bank, or $10,000 in the bank, you woke up on Monday morning with $1,600. That's it. And a promise that someday the government might give you the rest of it. Governments have that power. After all, we're dealing in fiat currencies. And in the case of people who think that they have wealth in the form of gold, they have receipts that say, in the depository, I have so much gold. In reality, they've got a piece of paper that can be revised in the morning, because your gold is stored by valuation, not by weights and measures. I prefer to have ounces of gold, not dollars of gold. Think about that one for a minute. So the global crisis that is, and the one that is to come, the crisis that is, the one that is presently taking place is, of course, the toxic credit situation inside the United States, where $4 trillion of our $12 trillion economy is being borrowed into existence every year on an annual basis, with new and additional internal debts being piled up on the commensurate basis on top of that. This is the present crisis. The crisis to come is that the Austrian School of Economics calls the correction crisis. This is the economic crisis which is bound to occur when fundamental economic laws reassert themselves. And when that happens, the accumulated economic errors and mistakes correct themselves. And they do this by writing the malinvestments and overinvestments down to their real values. And then the losses are written off. Well, that happened to us in the year 2000. Do you remember that, boys and girls? The stock market is sitting up here at 11,600 in round numbers. And all of a sudden it goes down to 7,000 or 7,000 and some change. And we wrote off $7 trillion in value. It was overvalued. It was paper profit. It was pieces of paper that said, if we cashed these in today, here's how much we would have. But in reality, if everybody cashed them in all at the same time, there wasn't enough money out there to pay for that anyway. If every American took all of his assets and went down to Walmart today and turned it into hard goods, you'd get 2 cents on the dollar. That's your prorated share. I think you'd be wise to take your dollar-denominated assets down to Walmart and get 100 cents on the dollar today and let everybody else out there in society share the shortage in the future. And somebody's going to write me and say, oh my God, you're selfish. Well, that's because I'm no longer a communist. Communists stand in line and share the shortage. Communists practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his needs. A capitalist takes his wealth in property and maintains his wealth in property and has physical possession of his property, because that is in fact his property, not an equitable interest in somebody else's. And when you're holding a piece of paper, you have an equitable interest in a share owned by a whole bunch of other people, from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. That's why you see Russians and Chinese, at least in historic times, standing in line to share the shortage. When the Chinese and the Russians went to a capital economy, the bread lines ceased. People aren't standing in line anymore. When they practice property and property rights, they have an abundance. Now, you'd think that we Americans, who are the authors of and the creators of our Bill of Rights and property rights under the common law, would have maintained that. But instead, we have adopted all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, while our communist enemies have adopted free market economics. And now the Chinese and the Russian economies are growing by leaps and bounds, pushing 10% a year, while America is inflating its currency and going into debt by 10% a year. As old William Bendix used to say, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. A revolting development. We are reviewing the book, America's Bubble Economy, written by David Wigmeyer, Ph.D., America's Bubble Economy, Profit When It Pops. Profit when the bubble economy pops. You can get a copy of it probably from Barnes & Noble. The second review is on The Privateer. Remember, The Privateer is published in Australia. The address down in Australia is Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. And if you've got a source for Indian black salve, remember, would you pass that on to me? I need a supply of Indian black salve. Hey, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to wrap it up. We'll take it up right here next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Meanwhile, you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The law hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these law hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Here, time is up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.